In August 2013, 33 miners were trapped underground in a mine in Chile. It took 6 weeks before finally a drill reached them, 630 metres underground. Punching a hole 30 centimetres in diameter through the roof of the cave that they were trapped in. 6 weeks of sitting in the dark with only torchlight to see by. But once that drill broke through and light from the surface shone down, they knew that rescue was close. Even though it took weeks longer to widen the hole and to lift the miners to safety, that drill and the light from the surface gave them the strength to keep going. It sent them the message, hang on, the end is close. Yes, it's difficult now, but rescue is coming. Now that's the message of these final chapters of Daniel. They are a shaft of light from the future. A message about the end, or to be more precise, the ends, and then a final end. It's a message about how kings and kingdoms will all finish, one after the other, all in God's time, and then how history itself will come to an end. And through it all, the message is that if you belong to God's people, things will be tough. You will be persecuted, whatever time you live in Daniel's time, in Jesus' time, today, into the future. But here is the message for God's people, don't worry. Things might be dark and tough, but there is an end, and that end will make everything worth it. So chapter 10 is about setting the scene for the message. It's about showing us what is under the surface. Let me explain. It begins in a familiar way. Look there in verse 1. It begins with a date and a dream. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a revelation was given to Daniel, who was called Belteshazzar. Its message was true, and it concerned a great war. Okay, another dream. It sounds familiar, doesn't it? And it's about a battle. Again. But there's something different here. He goes on to say, the understanding of the message came to him in a vision. Now that sounds like something different. And I think the rest of chapters 10 to 12 are about this second vision which explains the revelation. In other words, there's a revelation which Daniel finds hard to understand, and it's not described at all. But then there is this explanation which comes in another vision, and that is described for us. Let me explain. Daniel has this terrible revelation in verse 1 about wars. And then probably in response to what he sees, he goes on in verse 2. Verse 2, have a look at it. At that time, I, Daniel, mourned for 3 weeks. Just keep that period in mind. I ate no choice food, no meat or wine, touched my lips, and I used no lotions at all until the 3 weeks were over. And then when the 3 weeks are over, he gets a vision of a man, and that's from verse 4. We'll get to that man in a moment, but jump down to verse 12, where the man says, verse 12, do not be afraid, Daniel, since the first day that you set your mind to gain understanding and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I've come in response to them. But the prince of the Persian kingdom resisted me 21 days. Then Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me because I was detained there with the king of Persia. Now I have come to explain to you what will happen. So, it took 21 days for this man to come in response to Daniel's prayer. And Daniel had been fasting and probably praying for 3 weeks, same period of time. So here's what I think's going on. First, Daniel sees a vision that he can't understand. It's not described. Then he mourns and fasts and prays for 3 weeks. Wanting to know what it all means. And as soon as he begins to pray, God hears his prayer. The answer would have come straight away, but there's a 3-week delay, which we'll come to in a moment. Then when the 21 days are up, this man arrives with the explanation. It's another vision, and that's what is described for us in the rest of the chapters. Now, that whole series of steps, it's summarised back in verse 1, a revelation and then the understanding of it in a vision. So, let's look at the vision itself. Verse 5. I looked up, and there before me was a man dressed in linen with a belt of finest gold around his waist. His body was like chrysolite, his face like lightning, his eyes like flaming torches, his arms and legs like the gleam of burnished bronze, and his voice like the sound of a multitude. Who is he? We're not told. But he comes in response to Daniel's prayer to God. So he's from heaven. He's a messenger from heaven. Is he an angel? He's at least an angel. Is he more than an angel? Verse 13 tells us that Michael, who is an angel, helps him. Is he a representation of God himself? Perhaps Jesus. Some people say he's Jesus. The description is very similar to the description of Jesus in Revelation chapter 1, as the women who went to the Equip conference might have noticed. But he's not identified, so we can't say precisely, exactly. But at the very least, this man, he comes with all of God's authority. He speaks for God, he represents God. So how do we understand this delay 21 days after Daniel begins trying to understand? Well, verse 13, the man explains that the prince of the Persian kingdom resisted him. And it wasn't until Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help him that he was able to get away and come to Daniel. In the New Testament, Jude, verse 9, it describes Michael as an archangel or a chief angel. And in Daniel chapter 12, verse 1, which we also read, Michael is described as the great prince who protects the Jewish people. And then in verse 20 of chapter 10, we're told that the man is going to return to fight against the prince of Persia. And then after that, the prince of Greece will come. Now, putting all of these hints together, it seems like God rules over a spiritual battle that is going on between angels and heavenly armies and spiritual authorities. And there are angels, maybe good and bad angels, who are responsible for certain earthly kingdoms, for protecting them or for fighting for them or fighting against them or directing these earthly kingdoms. And the conflicts that we see happening at an earthly level, they actually reflect a battle that's going on at a heavenly level. Now, if that's the case, it helps us to understand some verses in the New Testament. Like in Colossians 2:15, it describes what God did when Jesus died on the cross. It said that God disarmed the powers and authorities. He made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them on the cross. That spiritual authorities and powers are being conquered in an earthly event. But that earthly event reflects a battle going on at a heavenly level. It's not just God who is involved in a spiritual battle. Ephesians chapter 6 describes how we're involved in a spiritual battle. Ephesians 6:11, Paul says, "Put on the full armour of God so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, the authorities, the powers of this dark world, and the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms." Now, all of this, Daniel chapter 10 and these verses, they're saying that your struggles as a Christian, they may look like everybody else's. They may look like the struggles of your friends. But at another level, beneath the surface, the struggles that you go through, the stakes are much higher. Much more is at risk. As you live as a Christian in a dark world, you are part of a great battle. As you battle to resist temptation, to speak with grace and wisdom among your friends who mock you, as you deal with an angry boss or uni lecturer who hates Christians, or as you live with unbelieving family members always pointing out your faults, as you pray and read your Bible, as you meet with other Christians to encourage each other, as you do all of those things, you are part of a battle that's shaking the foundations of the universe. A battle between spiritual forces in the heavenly realms. Little old you. And yet most people never notice. They never notice what's going on. It's like when you go to Sydney Aquarium. You walk past one of the giant pools and the water is smooth and still and it looks empty. But if you go down the steps to the observation desk, to the thick glass window that lies beneath the surface, it's a different matter entirely. What looked quiet and calm and deserted from the top is actually teeming with life. Fish and sharks and whales and coral and seaweed. All the action is underneath. And that's where you need to look to see what is going on in that pool. That's what you need to look at to see reality. And that's what it's like in this physical world that we live in. It is so much more than what you can see with your eyes. On the surface, it's just human actions. But behind those human actions, heavenly, eternal events are being played out. God is at work bringing about his purposes. Satan is working against him in any way that he can. That's what I think is being described here when this man comes and talks about princes who are fighting against one another. Daniel prays and prays, day after day, week after week. And it seems like nothing is happening. It seems like God is not interested or not powerful enough to answer. It seems like the aquarium pool when you look at the smooth, still water. But that's only on the surface. The reality is prayer is working. Prayer is tapping into a spiritual reality beneath the surface. God is powerfully working in his timing according to his plans. Now, that's true of our prayer too. Our prayer is not a waste of time. We should be encouraged to keep praying. Prayer is significant, powerful, important, offensive spiritual work. I wonder if that's how you think about your prayer. How you think about God. Or whether you need to look below the surface. Whether you need perhaps a fresh vision of who God is and how he is at work in his world. Perhaps you need a fresh vision of his power and awesome majesty. And then you need to show that in how you pray. Do you notice Daniel was paralyzed with fear when he saw the vision of this man? He was speechless. He was without strength. He couldn't stand or talk or hardly breathe. That's what it's like when you catch a vision of an angel of God, let alone when you catch a vision of God himself. Maybe we need a little more of that attitude of understanding who God is in his power. Well, that's chapter 10. The man strengthens Daniel, and finally Daniel's ready to receive an explanation of the vision. And that's what we see in chapter 11. We didn't read chapter 11. But it's about, once again, a series of kingdoms fighting against each other. It's like chapter 7, the first half of chapter 7. It's like the chapter 8. It's long and it's complicated and it's incredibly detailed. And it describes, at least up to verse 35, quite accurately a series of events that happened between about 500 BC and 150 BC. And it focuses on two rulers who are around Palestine and Egypt. But what you notice again and again is one kingdom falls and another kingdom rises to replace it. And each kingdom that falls and rises thinks that it'll be different this time. This will be the last. I will be the one who's victorious. It will succeed where everyone else failed. They all think that they will, they all try to keep their power in different ways. There's wealth, war, conquest, political alliances, intermarriage, trickery, treachery, robbery. But again and again, each one comes to its end. We're going to take a very quick sprint through chapter 11, so just follow along as I highlight some points, and I'll show you what I mean. So verse 2 of chapter 11, four kings will rise from Persia, one after the other. Verse 3 of chapter 11, a mighty king from Greece will rule as he pleases. That's Alexander the Great. But then, verse 4, his empire will be broken up. He doesn't last. Jump down to verse 6. The daughter of the king of the south will make an alliance with the king of the north, but she won't retain her power, and neither will he. Verse 7, one from her family line will rise and take her place. Or jump down to verse 11. The king of the south will do battle with the king of the north, who, even though he's got a large army, will be defeated, which leaves the king of the south. But at the end of verse 12, he'll slaughter thousands, but he won't remain triumphant. More battles through the next paragraph until we get to verse 18. A commander will put an end to his insolence, his pride. He'll stumble and fall to be seen no more. Then verse 20, his successor in a few years will be destroyed, but not in anger or battle. Verse 22, the prince of the covenant will be destroyed. Verse 25, the king of the south will wage war with a large army, but he won't be able to stand because of plots devised against him. Verse 27, the two kings with their hearts bent on evil will sit at the same table, lie to each other, but to no avail, because an end will still come at the appointed time. And again, verse 29, at the appointed time he will invade, but he'll be turned away, verse 30. He'll take out his frustrations on God's people. They'll firmly resist him. Now, from verse 36, many people believe that we actually jump forward from the 150 BCs to the end of time, and the subject changes to a final wicked figure who will act against God. Verse 36, he will keep it that up until the time of wrath is completed, for what has been determined must take place. Then there are more details of battles, verse 40. He'll invade many countries, he'll sweep through them like a flood. Many countries will fall until finally, verse 45, he will come to his end and no one will help him. Now, it's very quick. You might think, whoa, 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 there's so much going on there. But if you just step back for a moment and don't lose sight of the forest for the trees, what is the main impression you're left with about these future events? Well, I think there are two main things. Firstly, God knows what's going to happen, and it will all happen at its appointed time. God has all those events and he's just ticking them off. That's the first thing. And secondly, it doesn't matter who it is, how powerful they think they are, how they try to hold on to power, their end will come. Their power is limited, their time is limited. They're the two messages, I think. And so for Daniel, who, together with his fellow Israelites, was doing it tough. Daniel was still in Babylon. Some of the Jews had gone back to Jerusalem. Everything was up in the air. The message is, suffering won't be forever. One day, the attacks on God's people will stop. There will be an end. And so we come to chapter 12. At the end of the book, Its topic is about the ultimate or the final end, and it will make all of the suffering leading up to it worth it. And the focus shifts from the time of these kings around the 150 BC to the end of all things, to the end of time, the end of history itself. It's like this vision, you need to wear your bifocals. You need to focus through the bottom part of the glasses on the near future, on Babylon and Persia and Greece and Rome, through to the time of Jesus. But then you also need to look through the top part of your glasses and look to the distant future, chapter 12, to the end of history, the end of pain, the end of evil, the end of death. Verse 1 of chapter 12 describes one final time of distress, but then it will all end. But at that time, verse 1, your people, everyone whose name is found written in the book, will be delivered. Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. This life is not all there is. Everyone will be called to account, the good and the bad. You may not realise that there is resurrection for everyone. The weak and the powerful. Nothing that you do will be overlooked. No injustice or wickedness will be tolerated. And it will all be according to God's plan written in his book. Now what that means is that all of this is worth something. When you've been the victim of injustice, there is comfort in knowing that justice is coming. It makes whatever you endure now worth it. A few years ago, the Atheist Society in England put banners on buses that said, "There's probably no God, so stop worrying and enjoy your life." Now that's fine if your life is good, but what if you can't enjoy life? What if you are the victim of injustice? Or what if you suffer? What if you're persecuted? What is the fact that there's no God, what does that mean for you if you're enduring that sort of life? If there is no God, then that means there is no final justice. There's no restoration. There's no vindication. There's no hope. There's no purpose now. There's no ability to endure. There's no joy in the face of pain if there's no God. But that message is the complete opposite to what chapter 12 is telling us. Chapter 12 is saying there is a God, and he will not only bring all earthly kingdoms to an end, but there will be a final vindication. There will be final justice. So there is something to hope for now. There's something to strengthen your resolve and to give you resilience and endurance and hope. But it's not just justice for the wicked. Did you notice that? There's reward for the wise. Justice for the wicked, reward for the wise. Look at verse 3. Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens. And those who lead many to righteousness, like the stars forever and ever. That's a description of eternity for those who know God. It's an interesting way of describing it, isn't it? You will shine like stars, glorified bodies, freed from suffering and frustration and brokenness. That eternity is what awaits God's people. Those who now suffer mental health problems will shine. No more depression or anxiety or bipolar. Those who belong to God who are enduring now diabetes or kidney failure or celiac disease will shine. those enduring the aches and pains of old age who belong to God will shine. If your name is written in God's book of life, then that is the glorious future that awaits you, shining forever like stars. There'll still be suffering and injustice now, but one day all of that will be overturned and all rights will be restored. For Daniel, it was a long way into the future. He'd only seen the terrible events in his visions. In verse 8 of chapter 12, he's still confused. My Lord, what will be the outcome of all this? And he's told in verse 9, Cheryl pointed it out in the kids' talk. Did you see it? Go your way, Daniel, verse 9. Go your way, Daniel, because the words are closed up and sealed until the time of the end. Very much like Jesus' words, isn't it? Don't be anxious about tomorrow. Just deal with today. Go your way. Get on with your life. It's all going to happen a long time from now. Life will continue for a long time until we get to that day. Verse 10, many will be purified, made spotless and refined, but the wicked will continue to be wicked. None of the wicked will understand, but those who are wise will understand. I think that's describing life now. There will be wise and foolish. There will be wicked and righteous. Generations will come and go. And then he repeats his command. Verse 13, the end will come. As for you, go your way till the end. You will rest, and then at the end of the days, you will rise to receive your allotted inheritance. Get on with life. Live wisely, and then you'll rest. And then a long time from now, you will rise to an eternal inheritance. And it'll all be worth it. They're wonderful words, aren't they? They're words from God through that messenger to Daniel, but also to us. They're words that don't sugarcoat that there is suffering in the future for us. There is suffering. We need to be strong. But God will win in the end. God will win. Those words are even more wonderful for us than they were for Daniel. Those of us who live this side of Jesus, it is so much easier to see that light from the future. We know that God raised Jesus from the dead. Jesus is the first fruits of our resurrection. And there are majestic passages in the New Testament that describe more fully what that hope will be like. Not that just that we will shine like stars, but that justice will come and pain and suffering will be over. God has won all of that for us. Jesus has defeated every power and principality on the cross. Victory has been declared. That is certain. And so the question for us now is, are you living wisely? Are you living today in light of that future? Are you going your way? Are you getting on with God's business? Are you leading many to righteousness? Yes, struggling through injustice and persecution, but longing for and expecting deliverance. You see, wisdom means struggling through all of this, struggling through this life, but knowing that despite the appearances, God is fighting for you, and that in the end, God will win. Let's pray. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you for the book of Daniel. Help us to see beneath the surface of this world. Help us to see into the future, to recognise the certainty of your promise that you will return, that all the wrongs will be righted, and that those who are wise, who know you, will be rewarded. And may that give us strength to endure, to cope in this world. Amen.